This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Macro Voices episode 52 was recorded on March 3rd, 2017. I'm Eric Townsend. Real Vision co-founder and author of the popular Things That Make You Go Hmm newsletter, Grant Williams, joins me as this week's featured interview guest. We'll be discussing the global rise in populism, where the trend is headed, and what it means for markets, Donald Trump's presidency, the U.S. dollar, gold, and much, much more.
And I'm Patrick Ceresna. Eric, that S&P 500 exploded higher on Trump's speech all the way up to the 2400 level, and now has given back almost half of that. What's your feeling about the S&P here?
Weren't we just last week or the week before announcing the big news that it broke above 2300? You know, so another, it was at 100 points a week. It'll be 2500 next week. You know, what this reminds me of, Patrick, is the summer of 1999. What happens in the final stages of a bull market is you get to this crazy stage. Remember when tech companies didn't need revenues or earnings or even customers or even a viable business plan? Just page views was enough to send valuations to the moon. People were talking about in a new economy, suddenly the old metrics didn't matter anymore, and this time was different, and all that. Now, I wanted to short tech stocks in the summer of 99. Thank heavens I didn't do that. And the reason is I had just sold. I was a software entrepreneur. I sold a software company in the summer of 98. And I knew, there was zero doubt in my mind, that we were in a bubble, in the late stages of a bubble. But what would have happened had I shorted tech stocks in 99, in the summer of 99? They had another 50% to move to the upside before it all finally blew up in 2000. So the rule of thumb here is these things go on longer than most of us skeptics think is possible. And who knows how long it can go. I do think that we're seeing a lot of signs of being in the final stages of a bull market where retail investors are piling in. There was a massive, massive inflow last week of over $8 billion in a single week into the SPX ETF. So we're seeing these signs of just irrational exuberance, people piling in while the smart money is quietly selling. At least that's my belief as to what's happening here. How long does it go? How much higher do we move in this market before reality sets in? I don't know. I have no way of knowing. So you definitely don't want to be short this market because the trend is very strongly up. I personally am not a momentum trader. I don't want to try to trade this. If I were going to try to trade the upside, it would be with calls because I think at some point this party's going to come to an end and it ain't going to be pretty. Trump and the Fed can definitely influence how this will end and how long it takes before it ends. But it's going to end. It's inevitable. And when it does, it's not going to be pretty.
All right, now let's move on to that dollar index because the U.S. dollar index just broke out above the 102 handle. Again, just strength right after that Trump speech. Is this the breakout?
You know, I think it is. It's interesting. I'm seeing a lot of smart people with an opposing view saying that they really think Trump is going to find a way to contain the ascent of the dollar, stop it. And I think that's a very, very good intuition that Mr. Trump understands that he needs a weaker dollar. He's smart enough to get it. But I don't see any actions that he's taking yet that are going to produce that outcome. So far, it's just jawboning. So I do think that what we're seeing is a move back to the upside. We really need to see north of 103 to really confirm for me that the trend has changed. But it sure looks like it's headed in that direction. I think Grant Williams is probably going to have an opposing view. So stay tuned for a different perspective on this.
Now let's talk about crude oil. Now crude oil once again tested up toward that 55 level and then a big sell day today, dropping it down to the 52 handle. We've been talking about when is this breakdown going to actually occur? Is this it?
I think that it's upon us. I do think that 55 was that key resistance level. A lot of people thought that maybe on inventory day we'd get a breakout above that. We had a brief test at 55.03, did not break out above it. And, you know, now we're back down to the bottom of a short-term channel. And I think that we are set probably to head at least to, let's say, a 45 or so on West Texas Intermediate if this trend continues. Now, of course, there's a caveat there, which is that we don't yet know what Donald Trump's intentions relative to ISIS are. If there is a sudden bombing campaign in the Middle East, that will change everything. But failing that, I think we have seen this resistance be tested a couple of times. I think the market very firmly rejected that 55 level. And we remember we're looking at, in terms of number of contracts, all-time record high speculative long interest. That means that if this sell-off continues, that money's going to get squeezed out. It's all hot money in those oil futures, and they're going to be forced to cover their losses, close their positions. Selling begets more selling. Before you know it, we're looking at 45. So I'm definitely bearish. The one caveat, again, is we don't know what Donald Trump's intentions with ISIS are going to be. I have a theory about how that could play out. I'll save that for the feature interview with Grant Williams.
Well, absolutely. Now, I want to move on to gold. Obviously, in the face of that U.S. dollar breakout, gold's inverse correlation just immediately kicked in, and we are already $20 off this high point that it was at just a few days ago. What's your feeling about gold here?
Well, I'm still on hold because of my long dollar index view. And it's coming, you know, as far as gold itself, you know, what's happening with miners or, you know, gold fundamentals, I'm not even paying attention to that. What I'm doing is I'm looking carefully at my reasons for having a bullish view on the U.S. dollar. As long as I am still bullish on the U.S. dollar, I'm going to pass on gold here. I'm not necessarily bearish, but I think the strong dollar, especially if it strengthens toward 110, which I think is likely on the dollar index, then, you know, that's an awfully strong headwind for gold. If you're one of the people that really believes Donald Trump is a madman who's going to start a nuclear war, well, then you want to have physical gold in your possession so that it can be vaporized with you when the bombs land. But, you know, short of that, I don't really see the strong argument for gold. The thing is, if I'm wrong about the dollar index, if the many people, including Grant Williams, who see it the other way and think that the dollar is done here, then that will mean I missed the bottom on gold and will definitely regret it. I actually called that bottom to the day almost, and then by the time it hit, I had changed my view and I didn't buy it. So I hope that I didn't miss a final bottom there at 1124. We'll see what happens, and I think the only way that we're going to go substantially higher from here is if I'm getting the call wrong on the dollar. The dollar really is about to roll over, as a lot of smart people think it is. In that case, I missed the bottom in gold, and I will definitely regret that.
All right. Now, interest rates have been under quite a bit of pressure here as the 10-year yield is now once again approached that 2.5% level. What do you think's in store for bonds?
Well, I think this is entirely about the explosion in rate hike expectations. A week ago, the implied probability of a March rate hike from the FOMC was something like 20%. Now it's something like 80%. And of course, there have been four or five hawkish speeches from Fed governors in the last week. So all of a sudden, the 10-year is backing up toward 2.5%. No surprise there. I think it's entirely about rate hike expectations. And we have been down to 2.3%, you know, back when the rate hike expectations were implied at 20% instead of 80%. In the big picture, though, I still think we're treading water here. We haven't seen a crossing of any of those red lines in the sand that some of the famous people like Bill Gross and Jeff Gundlach have drawn, but we haven't seen the move in the other direction either. I definitely want to ask Grant Williams about this because I know he's done a tremendous amount of analysis and writing over the years about this massive problem of too much sovereign debt.
Oh, absolutely. Well, thanks for that market update, Eric. This week, we're happy to welcome back to the show Grant Williams. He is a portfolio strategy advisor for Valpez Investment Management, and he's the co-founder of Real Vision Television and the author of the Things That Make You Go newsletter. Also, stay tuned after the interview as Eric and I will be back to talk about options writing in a portfolio as an asset class. Eric's interview with Grant is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at MacroVoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me next on the program is Grant Williams, Real Vision co-founder and, of course, author of the extremely popular Things That Make You Go, newsletter. Grant, your views on the global rise in populism have been among the most prescient of any guest who's appeared on this program. You predicted the Brexit outcome, and you've described the rise of Donald Trump, Bernie Sanders, and various European politicians, including Marine Le Pen, as all being part of a connected global trend. Since our last interview, many of your predictions have come true. So bring us up to date on your outlook. What is driving the global rise in populism? What does it mean? And what's coming next for Europe, the United States, and the rest of the world?
Hey, Eric. Well, it's great to be back on and good to speak to you again. The populism thing is so interesting, and I think it's so important right now. And I think, you know, me predicting Brexit and Trump, I mean, that doesn't make me any great markets here. I think the beauty I had during those election campaigns was that I was in neither place. So I could sit back from a distance and look at it objectively, which I think both of those, the Brexit situation and the US elections, were so just electrified with high feelings on both sides. And it was really difficult if you were in the middle of that to be able to be objective about it. And so, you know, I think with the Brexit, the Brits have always had a kind of tenuous relationship with Europe. We were never really in the EU. You could just sense that when push came to shove, a lot more people were gonna vote leave than perhaps admitted. And I think once we saw what happened in the UK, from traveling around the US a lot, which I've done the last couple of years, it became really obvious to me that the phenomenon that we saw in Brexit was very much that you know, if you're a vote leave guy, you don't talk about it at dinner parties. It's just not socially the done thing in England. And so the polls kind of missed out that a lot of people weren't really were saying they were undecided, or they're saying they were going to vote stay when really they were going to vote leave. They just didn't want the social stigma. In the US, what was interesting to me as I traveled around talking to people, it was obvious that they were going to take that a step further, because to say that you were a supporter of Donald Trump, you were immediately labeled with every kind of ist that you don't want to be. You were a racist, a misogynist, you were a sexist, you were all these things. And so not only did people not just say they were voting for Trump or they were undecided, the very thought that you might be undecided and be thinking about voting for Trump in a certain kind of company was enough to kind of tie you with all those things. So I think people actively said they were going to vote for Clinton, because that was the more socially acceptable thing to say, whether you believed it or not. And so when people went into the poll booths, pulled the curtain behind their backs, it was much easier for them to vote their conscience. And when you look at – there are two maps on the internet. If you Google Trumplandia and the Clinton archipelago, you'll see the two most striking maps that I've seen regarding the U.S. election. And yes, we know Clinton won the popular vote, but if you look at these maps, it shows county by county the entire country. And it shows the strength of the vote for each candidate. And if you look at the map of America, the strength of the vote right across the middle of the country for Donald Trump was extraordinary. And then you flip the page to the Clinton archipelago, and you see just a rim around the edge of the country, which obviously includes the places like Los Angeles and San Francisco and New York and all the big cities where there's heavily concentrated populations. That's where Clinton got the vote. So you can see, looking at that map, that the groundswell of support for Trump was extraordinarily broad and remarkably deep. So that, you know, that's kind of where we are in terms of going forward from here. Well, we're going into election season now in Europe. And we've got some big ones coming up. The Dutch go to the polls in a couple of weeks' time. The big one is the French poll in May. And then further off in the distance, we have the Germans going to the polls in October. And my concern right now is that optically, to those people going to the polls in Europe, the UK looks like it's doing pretty well, having left the EU. We've seen the economy actually pick up. It was the fastest growing economy in the G7. I think it may have slipped to second place now, but it's done optically very, very well. And there's been no real fallout from Brexit other than the positive variety. So anyone going to the polls in Holland is going to look at the UK and say, well, you know, the Brits have done okay outside Europe. And anyone going to the polls in France is going to say, well, yeah, you know what? The old Brits don't seem to be doing too bad. Now, the Brexit effect may work its way through the snake and come out in the British economy later this year, but by then it'll be too late. So, you know, I think Le Pen is going to struggle to win, to be honest with you, but French politics is such it's such a snake pit. And we've seen already what's been happening to Fionn and his wife being taken into custody yesterday. So really anything could happen. And Le Pen winning would surprise a lot of people. I don't think globally it would be as big a surprise as the election of Donald Trump was. But I think in Europe, if Le Pen was to win, and we're seeing this reflected in spreads of the oats over the German Bunds, if Le Pen was to win, it would really rip the core away from Europe, and it would be a real problem for the Eurocrats to try and keep that thing together. So I think, as I say, we go into the season now, this populism trend, it really isn't over, and it's not going to die down now that Trump has been elected, particularly as he's gone straight into power and has done things that his base are loving. There are easy things for him to do. He's doing what he promised. And so if you are a populist, you've got a pretty good tailwind at the moment. And that is destabilizing for the world. It increases volatility in the world. And those, generally speaking, are two things that markets don't like, although you wouldn't know that right now as this Trump rally goes on. So I think we're going to see more of this populism. I don't think we're going to see the sort of the left, the status quo coming out in their millions to vote and keep the status quo. I think the agitators are going to be emboldened by what they've seen overseas. And I expect this to continue in Europe. And I think the whole, the Dutch referendum, the Dutch election in the next few weeks is going to be the start of that. And I suspect Wilders will win and run on a very anti-EU, anti-Euro platform. So Europe has another summer of love coming. And I think markets need to be ready for it.
What do you think the core driver is for all of this? Because a lot of people have said, well, this rise in populism is just because everybody around the world is frustrated with the global elites and the government and so forth. But if you look at it, really, it's not, you know, the government against the people. It's the people dividing. And you saw it in the case of Brexit in the UK, as you described. You see it again in the United States with the Clinton versus Trump thing. There is no moderates left. Everybody either thinks that if you, you know, didn't vote for Hillary, you should be hung by the neck until dead, or it was your God-given, you know, duty to vote for Trump because he's the savior. We get such divisiveness with people so polarized with opposite views. How did that get started, and what does it mean? Because I can't help but think, we've talked about war in our past interviews, I can't help but think, you know, what causes a war when people have irreconcilable differences, extreme views? Is that where this is headed, and what do you see coming next?
Well, it's tough to say that's where this is headed, but suddenly, you know, after a few short years, you can now say with a degree of certainty that's where this could head. You know, that was a possibility that few people were willing to entertain just 2 or 3 years ago. And now I think we can all see a clear path to how we could accidentally fall into some kind of major conflict. And I think, you know, the start of this, you're absolutely right in what you say, Eric. I mean, this is not the government against the people. This is the people divided. And that stems from this massive surge in inequality that we've seen, which, you know, I'm sorry, I hate to go back to this, but I think a lot of this can be laid at the feet of the central banks and the policies they've enacted to try and quote unquote save the system. You know, the system is essentially run by the haves. They're the guys that fund the system. They have the capital. They're the guys whose money is sloshing around the system, so to speak. And so by saving the system, you are saving the people that have wealth. And what they've done is made those people a lot wealthier. And you know, you can look at the charts about the, you know, there's the great stat recently about the 8 guys have the same amount of money as 90% of the world's population. You know, it's insane for these things to happen. But ironically, as the central banks and the governments have tried to keep the lid on this, they've done so by telling everybody how well everything's doing, how everything is getting better and they're making great strides and, you know, everything's coming back and the economy's coming back and the jobs coming back. And you know, that's not true. And at the very best, it's kind of putting lipstick on the pig. And so people are listening to that on the one hand, but they're not seeing it in their pay packets. They're not seeing it in their cost of living, which is going up. They're not seeing it in the cost of healthcare. They're not seeing it in all the expenditures that they have to make. And you know, the non-discretionary stuff is going higher. And they feel frustrated because they feel like they're being lied to and told everything's getting better. And they're thinking, well, you know, if it is getting better, it's not getting better for me. So it just amplifies this divide between the haves and the have-nots, because the haves they're not struggling. I mean, you know, the guys that have assets and have capital have done incredibly well since the era of quantitative easing began. So they're not feeling this. I mean, they probably might sit around at dinner parties and talk about, hey, you know, isn't the cost of a holiday in, you know, the south of France going up this year? But it's not, they're not feeling it. You know, they're kind of seeing it and they're experiencing it, but they're not feeling it. Whereas at the other end of the economic scale, these guys are struggling. And there haven't been any wage increases, and the cost of living, the CPI is not 1%. You know, the things you need, it's a lot higher than that. And so they feel like not only they're being lied to, but their inherent faith in anybody in a suit and tie behind a microphone is such that when those guys are saying, you know, it is getting better, things are on the up, they think, well, they're telling the truth. So that just means it's other people that are doing better than me. So I completely understand where this is coming from. And I really do think that this is an extension of central bank policy of eviscerating the middle class in an attempt to save, quote unquote, the system. And I think when history looks back at this, we get the denouement of this era of central bank omnipotence. History is not going to be very kind to these guys. And I think justifiably so.
On that theme of asset markets doing well in this environment, let's go back to Donald Trump in particular, because the stock market is telling us that all of President Trump's aspirations will be realized. The economy will be great. Corporate profits will go through the roof thanks to his tax cuts. The protectionist policies that he's threatening to impose won't pose any serious problems. And his habit of infuriating entire governments and their peoples, notably Mexico and China, are apparently no cause for concern. Now, personally, Grant, I'm a little bit more pessimistic than that. What's your view? But more importantly, what the heck is going on that markets or investors in general are seeing this is unconditionally positive? And we've got what has to be the most contentious U.S. president of our lifetime. I mean, how could that be happening?
Yeah, I'm totally in your camp, Eric. And I think, again, I hate to keep harping on this, but if you look for the linkages, they're very, very clear. I recently gave a presentation in South Africa. And in that presentation, I was talking about volatility and how volatility has repeatedly been crushed ever since Mario Draghi's Whatever It Takes speech. And I spoke to a brilliant guy called Chris Cole at Artemis Capital about this, who's one of the best vol traders in the world. And you know, when I spoke about this, it's clear that the central banks have actively sought to dampen volatility because volatility makes skittish markets, and skittish markets are unpredictable. And so when you get the Trump trade coming on, we all knew going into this, we all knew what the potential downsides were. And I think often when you see markets react emotionally, you get the real temperature. And if you remember the night of the election, the market fell 1,000 points on the possibility that Trump might win. And I think that instant, unfiltered, knee-jerk reaction when Trump was going to get in with people to sell, at some point, those things tend to reassert themselves. And so, you know, I think what's happened since then is the markets have basically looked at Trump's policies. They've picked out the ones that they believe are positive for the markets, you know, tax cuts being the big one, infrastructure spending, reduction of regulations, which are all inarguably, or certainly the first, the tax cuts and the regulations are inarguably positive for markets. And once again, they've gone back to this idea that, well, you know what, if something bad does happen, if the markets do get skittish, if we do end up with a big deficit, whatever the potential negative outcomes are, well, the central banks are going to step in again. They're not going to let these markets go down. And I think that's what the markets are doing. This central bank put, you know, started off as the Greenspan put, turned into the Bernanke put, and now it's just a ubiquitous central bank put that all the central banks in the world are working together. And when you look at the Fed balance sheet that's been reduced very gradually for the last couple of years, you know, at the same time, the baton's been picked up by the People's Bank of China and the ECB and the Bank of Japan. So as a group, central bank balance sheets are still going up at a staggeringly alarming rate. So the markets have been conditioned to assume that there is a safety net there. So it's okay to walk the tightrope. And I think buying these markets at the valuations we're seeing, which are, you know, at or around all-time highs in just about every metric you want to look at, and the echoes from 2000 and 2007 are startling. Buying those markets is walking the tightrope. But when you believe that there's a really, really strong net below you, it's worth trying to get to the other side. And the other side is these markets keep going up forever and everybody makes a load of money and everything's great. But if the laws of mathematics alone start getting factored into this, you will see that Trump cannot have everything he wants and great bond markets and a great stock market. And the problem is really going to come in the bond market, because that's where it is pure math, right? This is the deficits, the funding, the interest rates, this is pure mathematics. There is a point at which the U.S. doesn't function because interest rates are too high, and every penny of their tax receipts are going on paying off the coupons. And you know, we're a long way from that, but very quickly, if we start interest rates start to quote unquote normalize, which the Fed is desperate to try and tell us they're going to do, you know, normal interest rates, I would say, would be maybe 4%, and that's possibly generous. Historically, you look and it's probably about 6%. But at 4%, it's something like $1 trillion is going to go to pay the debts off. And that has to come from somewhere. It's going to come from military expenditure? Probably not, not with what Trump's saying. Is it going to come from the infrastructure spending? Well, yeah, possibly. Does it come from Medicare, Medicaid? We don't know, but it has to come from somewhere, or they have to sell a ton more bonds to pay for it. This is just pure mathematics. But people are ignoring that for now because they feel like if things get squirrely, the Fed are going to run to the rescue once again. And all the Fed, to my mind, now have is the market's confidence in their abilities. And as I keep saying, that confidence is such an ephemeral thing, it can disappear for seemingly no reason at all. And to be trying to suck the air out of what's left of these markets with something based on such a flimsy foundation, to me, is just it's just a very reckless, foolhardy thing to do.
Oh, Grant, you must have missed the memo on what Donald Trump said he's going to do. He's very concerned about the national debt. He's going to reduce it dramatically, while at the same time also reducing taxes and increasing spending on infrastructure dramatically, all at once. You said mathematics. I'm sorry. Okay.
Yeah, you're exactly right. I don't think I did get the memo, Eric.
I want to come back to this subject of the national debt and the bond market a little bit later on. But while we're on Donald Trump, I'd like to share a couple of thoughts with you and ask you for your reactions, because I trade crude oil very actively, and I therefore have to think a lot about geopolitical risk. And it occurs to me that probably one of the strongest messages of Donald Trump's campaign was defeat ISIS, get tough with ISIS. Since he took office, though, there was a very quiet announcement saying that he was asking the Joint Chiefs of Staff to prepare some kind of plan or proposal, and that was it. We haven't heard a peep about it. And it occurs to me, Grant, we've all been conditioned to expect this new cable news era mode of warfare that's existed since the Gulf War 25 years ago, where what happens is first there's some signaling, some messages, some warnings, which I would contend exist not so much to warn the enemy, but to prepare the American people that for something big may be coming. Then you get the big dramatic press announcement, you know, my fellow Americans, we've gone to war and this is what's happening. And then it becomes this media thing that goes on, you know, day 14 of the conflict, and we've got live coverage on CNN. What do you think, Grant, if you think about some of the other things that Trump has said about how we have given away our secrets to enemies and how intelligence has been collected by the bad guys watching CNN on cable? What if what happens is there's not a peep about this until one morning President Trump announces military operations have commenced, we are going to defeat ISIS. There will be no further information given until it's over, because we're not going to show our cards to the enemy. There will be a complete press briefing on all aspects of what happened after the conflict is ended and after the enemy has been defeated. Until then, there will be no further comment from the government. Thank you. That is all. It feels to me that that could be what we're setting up for, because we haven't heard a word about ISIS, and he has said those things. He has criticized past presidents for doing that. if that were to happen, you could have a sudden, just huge, huge market upset if there was no advance signaling and all of a sudden it was, we're at war and the president is not willing to tell you why or what's going to happen next. Am I crazy to worry about a scenario like that? Do you think it's plausible?
Well, you know, in some ways, wouldn't that be great? You know what I mean? I mean, in some ways, wouldn't it be great to just not be bombarded with this stuff? But look, I think, as I said, markets hate uncertainty. And if he tried to do that, and I think it's unlikely, because if he's not reporting on it, everyone else in the world is reporting on it. And, you know, the Associated Press are going to be reporting on it. Reuters are going to be reporting on it. And CNN, Donald Trump's latest punching bag, are going to be reporting on it. So realistically, when you're in a position like he is, you have to control the information flow. And so to leave that in the hands of people who A, could go anywhere with it, and B, seemingly are not the best of friends, I think would be a very risky move on his part. I mean, could he do it? Hell, we've seen so far he could do anything, Eric. But I think that may be a step too far, because I think in times of war, these guys have to control the information. And if you abdicate that willingly, you leave the information flow to anybody else. And that's a very, very dangerous thing to do in this day and age. So I think it's unlikely.
I want to move on to some other major trends. You recently penned a two-part series in Things That Make You Go, titled Peak Optimism. And we do have a download link for the first of that two-part series as a free sample for our registered users. And that's already in your Research Roundup email. Please give us the executive summary, Grant. What's driving peak optimism? What do you mean by peak optimism? And why is it important for investors to understand it? Where are we headed from here?
Well, I think again, this comes back to what we were talking about with the central banks and this idea that everything's okay. And what I was trying to point out to me, and this went back to a conversation I had with John Malden several years ago at his conference, and he asked me where I thought the biggest bubble in the world was. And I said at the time, it was confidence. It was confidence, a bubble in confidence in the central banks. And obviously since then, that's actually gone up, which is remarkable. And so the point of this piece I wrote was just to show people that just how tenuous this is. And with markets where they are, investors, intelligence, bullish readings off the charts, and this crazy rally after the Trump presidency, I was just talking about some of the things that could go wrong. You know, obviously the big one for me was Donald Trump, simply because he's such an unknown quantity. And I talked about the very first day he took office, more or less, when he got the congratulatory phone call from the Taiwanese. And, you know, if you look through his proposed cabinet, you'll see a very antagonistic group of people put in the front line to deal with the Chinese. Navarro is a very well-known opponent of China, let's call him. He's written all kinds of books with titles like Death by China and The New Heart of Darkness about the yoke of Chinese imperialism. And he's put Lighthizer as his trade negotiator, who again, deliberately and overtly antagonistic towards the Chinese. So that's just one thing that could go wrong. Forget about the bond market. Forget about Trump's just ability to be a wild card. There are so many things that could burst this bubble of optimism, including currency moves by foreign governments. So many. You know, this just isn't in the control of any one person. And all these countries are coming under their own pressure from their people to try and deliver what's essentially the undeliverable without fracturing relations somewhere else around the world. So, you know, I think we are at this peak of optimism, of this faith in the ability of the people behind the microphones to tell us everything's all right and to make it so, not from a societal perspective, because I think that's, as I said earlier, that's the genesis of this populist movement, but from a market perspective. I think the markets are still believing that and saying, okay, fine, they've got this. They've proven over the last 8 years that they're not going to let the markets go down. We're optimistic about their ability to keep doing that. And we're going to keep buying these markets. And as I said, that's a really dangerous reason to buy stuff, just because you have faith in a group of human beings to control a natural organism like a marketplace. it's a very dangerous thing to do, because ultimately the only way they can really do it when it starts to assert itself are by some really draconian measures. You know, we're talking capital controls. We've seen those before. We've seen things like FATCA get enacted so that the US can understand where the money is. And as a good friend of mine said to me recently, that's the first step. You work out where the money is, and then you ring fence it. And then when you need it, you can go take it. And, you know, make no bones about it, at some point in time, they are going to need it. There are $100 trillion in unfunded liabilities coming due before 2025, I think, for Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, et cetera. They're going to have to get that money from somewhere, and they will end up printing it, because they've proven that to us. So I do worry that markets are very complacent. We see that in the volatility numbers. They're very confident in the ability of the Fed. We see that in the constant buying of the dips. And so far it's worked, which is great, right? If you've been long the equity markets the last couple of years, you've had a pretty good time of it. We had a wobble in January, February last year when they quickly stepped in with the Shanghai Accord to stop that little wobble. Since then, we really haven't had any downdraft to speak of. And so, of course, there's complacency. So that was essentially what I was trying to get to, just to let people understand just how over our skis we are here, and the fact that it's based on something that is ultimately has very little chance of working forever. In fact, I would say it has zero chance of working forever. And to be in a market where you, like everybody else, figure you're going to get out before the next guy, it's just no place I want to be. I've seen how that movie ends. So we saw that in 1987. We saw it in 2000. We saw it in 2007-08. And it'll happen again. It always happens again.
You mentioned the role of China in all this a minute ago, and I'd like to come back to that, because in your most recent Things That Make You Go Hmm newsletter, you wrote quite a bit about China, from what you describe as a dangerous myth that they need $2.7 trillion in reserves to the precipitous drop in treasury holdings that's occurred just in the last few months. Meanwhile, we've heard quite a few views on China from our other guests that are just dramatically different, ranging from, you know, the end is nigh and we should brace for a global deflationary shock when Chinese debt defaults force the PBOC to dramatically devalue the yuan overnight. And on the other end of the spectrum, we've had very smart people tell us that there's absolutely nothing wrong, everything's fine, and there's nothing to worry about. So let's tie this all together. I mean, clearly China now plays a very, very important role in the global economy. Is it broken or not broken? What are the factors that investors need to understand most about China? And where does the Chinese debt overhang in particular fit into this whole story? And where are we headed from here?
Well, this is the beauty and the frustration of China. It's the opacity around it is just enough that none of us really know, right? We just don't know. We're all looking at the numbers. We're looking at the massive increase in debt that we've seen in China, which by any other metrics you look at and you say, well, that can't last. That just doesn't work. That's unsustainable. We have enough disbelief in the numbers that come out of the Chinese ministries about the performance of the economy. You know, this idea that the GDP of 1.4 billion people can be calculated within a few days at the end of the quarter and never revised is laughable, frankly, but there is a great deal of don't ask, don't tell about this. And if the Chinese say it's 6.5%, even if we think it's 4%, for example, as long as we don't have to invest accordingly, we can stay invested and ride this thing. Because the being told it was 4% would mean a lot of hard decisions to be made for a lot of people. So it kind of works for both sides. You know, the truth is always somewhere in the middle. You know, the guys who say it's going to fall over tomorrow are most likely wrong. And the guys who say everything's fine are also most likely wrong. So everyone needs to kind of take a look at this for themselves and figure out which camp they come into. But I'd caution against getting too resolute in your convictions, because we just don't know. And you'll talk to guys that, like I do, that spend a lot of time in China, and they will tell you that, hey, look, you know, the economy seems to be humming along. That people are picking up stuff. There is real demand. These numbers are genuine. And, you know, I defer to them because they spend a lot more time on the ground there than I do. But I do understand. I've heard all kinds of stories about what people are shown when they go to China, you know, buzzing factories and stockpiles of commodities. And they're just being shown something that they wanted to see. And so the Chinese conveniently showed it to them. Whether it's real or not is beyond is beyond their understanding a lot of time. So, you know, we don't know. The currency and the outflow of reserves and the selling of treasuries, I think, is important to notice because, you know, they're real and we can see what they're doing with the currency. They are trying to weaken that gradually. But really, whenever I think about China, you come back to this idea that the real problem for the Chinese is always inflation, because social unrest is the Achilles heel of the Chinese. You know, you have nine guys in charge of that 1.4 billion people, and those 1.4 billion people know where those nine guys live, and they have a habit when they don't get fed or it's too expensive to put food on the table of getting kind of angry about it. So I think you have to understand that that's really their goal. It's social stability, and they will pull the levers accordingly to achieve that. So, you know, I look at the treasury sales, which are really quite striking. They are that's clearly something they've been planning to do and are actively and consciously divesting themselves of treasuries. And I think a lot of that has to do with the gold market. It has to do with the currency market. It has to do with the oil markets, potentially. Perhaps we can talk about that in a minute. But I think you watch that, you watch the currency, and you watch these reserves. And the reserve thing is interesting because people talk about this, you know, $3 trillion in reserves. It's gradually slipping away. But they forget on the other side of the ledger to talk about the fact that China now does 25% of its trade in renminbi. So they don't need as many dollars as they used to need. So a lot of this divestiture is related to this increase in yuan-denominated trade. So it's not quite as cut and dried as people think. You know, this $3 trillion line in the sand that everyone was talking about is really not what it seems. But you have to watch this very carefully, knowing that you are never going to get the answer. I gave a presentation about 3 or 4 years ago, and my closing question to the audience was, having laid out a lot of reasons why I thought that China wasn't doing as well as perhaps the officials would have you say, or have you believe, is that if there was a recession in China, would we ever really know about it? Because if they're telling you that there's no recession, they're telling you that the numbers are X and Y. We can look at the electricity consumption, for example, all we like, as people used to do, look at the Li Ka-shing index. It doesn't really tell you anything. So I think everyone has to pick a side in China or stay out of the fight. And once you've picked your side, you have to recheck and recheck and recheck your case, you know, almost on a daily basis to make sure that you are on the wrong side of the boat, because I don't think the answer is the middle ground. I don't think it's going to muddle through like we've seen in some of the Western economies. I think it's either going to be okay or it's going to be a disaster in waiting. And, you know, I suspect just thinking about what's happened in the West and the difficulties that we've had in Western democracies to, as I keep calling this, to stick the landing, the fact that we're expecting the Chinese, you know, a first-generation capitalist, to pull off something that the US and the UK and every European economy singly failed to do in, you know, avoiding that recession and avoiding debt deleveraging and avoiding non-performing loans and bankruptcies, I think it's a big ask. So, you know, if you put a gun to my head and said, pick a side, I would pick the crash and burn side. But I'm checking that very, very carefully every chance I get.
You mentioned that the key markets to follow and understand here were gold, dollar index, and the bond market. So let's touch on those themes, starting with gold. You recently spoke at the Mines and Money Conference in London. Please give us the 2 to 3 minute executive summary. What was that presentation about?
I started off talking about Trump because it was early December and you kind of had to talk about Trump. And I was just trying to compare the economy that he's inheriting with that which Reagan inherited, as at that time he was being compared to Reagan. And they couldn't have been any different. I mean, Reagan inherited crazily high double-digit bond yields, double-digit inflation, an S&P at 7x earnings. So, you know, he had all the tailwinds behind him. I mean, things were going to go one way, and they were positive. And yet the market still lost 22% of its value in the next 18 months. Fast forward to today, and Trump has, you know, 24x earnings on the S&P and obviously zero rates, and the 10-year was trading, I think, at the time around 2%. He doesn't have anywhere to go. And so that was how I started off. And then we got into something a lot more interesting, which is what's happening in the gold markets. with the Chinese, particularly, and the Russians, steadily accumulating gold. Now both countries, as large producers of gold, haven't let an ounce of gold leave their own shores since 2009, I think it was, in the Russians' case. I'm sure I'll get corrected. And the Chinese, for even longer than that, they stockpile every ounce of gold that they produce. And the numbers show that the Chinese are shipping all kinds of gold in through Hong Kong, through the UK and Switzerland. And once that gold's going in there, it's not coming back. And the Russians very kindly announce their gold purchases every month, and they are relentless buyers of gold. Now, the Russians' ownership of gold helped to an enormous extent when the ruble was under pressure. And the Chinese, I believe, and this was actually a funny story, I found a piece of research in the backseat of an airplane about a year ago, which had no title on it, nothing. And I read this piece, and it connected so many dots that I'd been thinking about, and with the oil markets and China and gold. And I carried this piece of research around me for a year, asking everybody I would come across, do you know who writes this? Do you know who this is? Because there was just no identifying marks on it at all. And eventually I found out that this piece of research was written by a guy called Luke Grumman, who writes something called Forest for the Trees. And your listeners should absolutely check Luke out. He's on Twitter at Luke Grumman. And I tracked Luke down. I called him up and we went out for dinner and I sat and talked to him. And he's done some tremendous work on this. And not to get too deep into it, but basically the Chinese are essentially negotiating a lot of contracts directly to trade oil for renminbi with the Russians, with Iran. And through doing that and through the Shanghai Gold Exchange, where you can now take delivery of physical gold, once they put in place the physical oil contract, which they've been supposedly going to institute since 2015, they have said that the yuan will be fully convertible. Right now, it's a controlled currency, obviously, but once that oil contract is in place, then the yuan will be fully convertible under that contract. So if you sell oil to the Chinese for yuan through that futures contract, you will be able to get that yuan offshore. So you'll be able to essentially swap oil for gold by buying gold through the Shanghai exchange. And once you put the three legs of that stool in place, you essentially circumvent the petrodollar system, which has been the source of US dollar hegemony for the last 40 years. So it's really, really interesting what's happening right now. And if you look carefully, you'll see all the pieces of the jigsaw. And I wrote about this. I took Luke's work, did a lot of reading, put some more stuff together. And people can see that that presentation. It's called Get It, Got It, Good. And if you search for it on YouTube, you'll find it. And it lays out the dots quite clearly. But there is something happening in these markets that, if you join those dots, spells real trouble for the US dollar, spells real trouble for the US, and is a significant power play on the part of the Chinese particularly, but also the Russians. So it's fascinating stuff, and I would recommend, if you want to find out more about it, watch that presentation and look for Luke Grumman's work and engage with him on Twitter.
And our registered users can find a link to that YouTube video of your presentation at the Minds of Money Conference in the Research Roundup email that they received in conjunction with today's podcast. Before we leave the subject of gold, I want to touch briefly on one more aspect of this, which is you wrote recently about the gold-copper ratio. So let's start with why this ratio is important, what it means, what it tells us, and then particularly talk about the pairs trade that was just signaled when the ratio touched its long-term trend line.
Yeah, it's interesting. The bullish dollar, bearish commodities, you're bullish copper if you think there's going to be a lot of infrastructure spending. And gold, really, gold to me is money. I don't think of it as a commodity because I don't think it trades like a commodity. And so when you look at what's happened on the back of Trump's election with this promised infrastructure spend, you've seen the price of copper go through the roof, while gold has really done nothing. And if you look at a chart of the copper-gold ratio, it got way out of line, and in terms of copper being way stronger than gold, and it's touched a trend line that to me signals a great buying opportunity to actually sell copper and buy gold. And for me, that's a play on two things. One is this infrastructure spend that Trump promises takes a lot longer to get through than is expected, which to me is a given. I just think he's going to struggle to get that kind of stuff through. B, it's going to be watered down. And again, if you go back to the Japanese, who've done, I think, 24 of these extra budgets, surplus budgets, and each time what's been delivered has been less than what was promised. I think Trump's going to be see the same thing. You're going to see weakness in the sort of base commodities, the construction commodities, and I just think that the one inflation that no one's talking about as we arm wrestle over is it going to be deflation, is it going to be inflation, is the nightmare that is stagflation. And I can see a very clear path to a stagflationary environment. And if I'm right about that, then being short copper and long gold is a great way to play that. Now, a dear friend of mine, Simon Hunt, who writes extensively on China, spends a lot of time in China every year and is really clued into this stuff. You know, he wrote me a nice email after he read that piece. He said, "Oh, look, you know, I think you're wrong about this. I think the Chinese demand for copper is real and it's going to ramp up and they're doing all kinds of things with it." So, you know, that's a warning to people. But to me, I look at that ratio and I think being short copper at this price and long gold is a sensible thing. Is a sensible bet on Trump not getting everything he wants. It's a sensible bet on possible stagflation, and it's a great bet on a return to the mean for both commodities. So, you know, I like that very much.
Speaking of the dollar index, let's go back to that. A lot of people are saying now that the dollar rally is over because President Trump wants it to be over. Other people, have, myself included, have pointed out that, well, he may say that. A lot of his policies, such as asking multinational corporations to repatriate assets to the United States, are actually dollar bullish despite the opposing rhetoric. So Mr. Trump definitely needs a weaker dollar to achieve his goals. Is that what drives it? It sounds like you have a bearish view on the dollar index, whereas I think your partner, Raoul Paul, still has a bullish view. Is it driven by Donald Trump or by something else? And do you think that Trump can find a way to, you know, overcome this ascent of the U.S. dollar?
Well, yes, I think absolutely they can overcome this. And my bearishness on the dollar right now is, well, A, I think it's, I just think, I don't think it's going to go to the places that the bulls think it's going to go. I will caveat that in a second, but I think that to me, that the pain that a stronger dollar would cause right around the world is such that the central banks will have to get together. You know, we will see another Plaza Accord type deal be forced on people. There's just too much dollar denominated debt in the world that needs rolling over. They have proven their willingness to print dollars, and I think Trump does need a weaker dollar. And if you look at the reaction to the markets when he just came out in an interview and said, "Yeah, you know, the dollar's too strong, the Chinese are killing us." I mean, the dollar had the biggest fall it's had in about 5 years the next day. I mean, that's all he said. So the dollar is very responsive to jawboning. It always has been. You know, in both directions. But I think the one thing that does give me pause for thought is just this structural short position of physical dollars, i.e. the amount of dollars that have been borrowed and need to be paid back. It, you know, every dollar that's been borrowed is a short dollar position. That's the one thing that, you know, I believe could possibly get out of control if we do see people scrambling to get hold of physical dollars. But I suspect if that happens, there will be a very concerted effort to supply dollar liquidity. And it's not something that they will struggle to do because they've proven in the past that they're very happy to do that. So that's my caveat. But I think if you take out a short squeeze, which sounds like a crazy thing to talk about in the case of the world's reserve currency, but if you take out the idea of a short squeeze, to me, with the Chinese divesting themselves of treasuries, with the US absolutely needing a weaker dollar, with Asia needing a weaker dollar, I just think the power is lined up against letting the dollar get too much stronger from here. So I suspect they will actively stop it going, you know, to these crazy levels that the real dollar bulls think, you know, up another 15, 20, 25% from here. I just don't think that can be allowed to happen.
You have written a tremendous amount about the massive, massive and crazy overhang of sovereign debt around the globe, not just the United States, but really all developed nations have just a ridiculous amount of sovereign debt. So where does that leave you at this juncture on this debate about, is the 35-year bond bull market really over, as Jeff Gundlach thinks, or does it have further to go? How do you see fixed income and treasuries in particular going from here?
Yeah, I bore myself talking about this stuff now, to be honest with you, because you're right. I've written so much about it, and it hasn't seemed to matter. But as I keep saying, none of this stuff matters to anyone until it matters to everyone. And I think the case of the bond bull market, I would say it's over, but it's not over yet. I don't think we're going to see this continued grind lower and into negative territory. But my feeling is we are going to see one more dash into sovereign debt. I think we're going to get a recession. I know the data is reasonably firm at the moment, but I think that's going to be transitory. I think we will get a recession in the US. And when that happens, people are going to want to own treasuries. And if we get a stock market correction, which we could at any point in time, people are going to want to own treasuries. And I think what we've seen in the past has been, to your point, a rush into sovereign debt. I don't care which country I get, but all these central banks, they're all on the same page. Sovereign debt is the place to be. I think the next time, with Europe fraying at the edges, with the Bank of Japan, I think having gone a step too far in, first of all, instituting negative rates, but more importantly, pegging the curve at 10 years, that to me was a very foolish thing for them to do. So I think when this next panic into sovereign debt comes, it's going to be focused on US treasuries because they will be deemed the safest of safe havens. And I think whether we see new lows or not, I don't know, but I think it's distinctly possible in yields. But I think you're going to see a lot of money trying to get long treasuries in a hurry one more time. And I think that will be the end of the 35-year bull market.
Before we close, I'd like to get an update on what you guys are up to over at Real Vision Television. When we had your partner, Raoul Paul, on the show a few weeks back, he told us that Real Vision would be launching a free podcast of its own this spring. Can you give us an update on that project? When does the first show go live on iTunes, and how can our listeners find out more about it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this revolution we started through the airwaves is something that we're trying to extend with our own podcast, which we're going to call Adventures in Finance. And the idea is we want to try and do to podcasts what we have been trying to do and continue to try and do in financial television, which is basically get past all the hype and the kind of junk stories and just disrupt the way that that information and analysis around the world of finance is shared. But we want to do it for a broader audience. I mean, this isn't just for kind of heavyweight investors, the kind of guys that listen into Real Vision. This is for people that are just trying to get a foothold in finance and trying to understand it. We're trying to make this as relevant, as accessible as we can for everybody. I mean, we've built Real Vision on this foundation of truth in finance, and we want to try and take that to a wide audience. The podcast world is a great way to do that. And we want to share some of the ideas of these great investors that we have on and get it out to as many people as we can. So the podcast is going to air every Thursday at 9 o'clock on Eastern time. I'm going to host it with your good friend of mine, Aaron Chan, and it'll be out in iTunes if people search for Adventures in Finance. And it'll launch next week on iTunes. So we're really excited about it. And, hopefully I think you and I speak to a lot of the same people. I think our audiences are similar. They're very engaged, very smart financial people. And I think they'll enjoy what we're going to put out here.
Fantastic. Well, I look forward to listening to it. We are up against our time limit, so I just want to mention very quickly, everybody these days knows you as the Real Vision guy because you've become a celebrity there. But I want to mention also your very, very popular newsletter, Things That Make You Go, Hmm. Unfortunately, we don't have time today to get into a discussion about it, but we were able to secure permission to send it. It's a paid newsletter, but Patrick was able to get your permission to send a couple of recent sample issues out. So we've got links to those in the research roundup email that registered users at macrovoices.com already received. If you haven't registered yet, just go to macrovoices.com, register, log in. Once you're logged in, click on the black research library tab on the black menu bar, and you'll be able to find that download. So Grant, I cannot thank you enough for another fantastic interview. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, I have to say, I really enjoy Grant's work, and I've been a longtime reader of his newsletters. When listening to that interview, what really stood out to me was his view that it's premature to be putting the nails in the coffin on that 35-year bond bull market. What's your feelings about the interview?
You know, I think that point that you just mentioned coming from Grant was particularly telling for me, because Grant's been the guy who's been probably the most outspoken of anyone I can think of, saying that this crazy, crazy accumulation of a huge amount of debt overhang, of sovereign debt around the globe, and the ridiculously low yields that we've come to, you know, it all has to end badly someday. So for Grant himself to say, but I don't think that day is quite yet, I think that this business cycle is long in the tooth. We've got another recession coming, and that's probably going to be the last hurrah for bonds. I found that particularly fascinating. Anyway, in our prior conversations, you sparked my interest when you talked about treating option writing as an asset class. Now, before you started running BigPictureTrading.com, you worked for CIBC, where you were trading an option writing portfolio, where the portfolio manager treated the funds as a separate asset class for his clients. Now, I thought that was a fascinating topic to discuss. So why don't you describe the theory behind it?
Well, this is actually a topic or a strategy that I'm very passionate about, because, you know, in the financial world, you find an overabundance of managers just tripping over each other, trying to create alpha through like rigorous analysis of a company's financials or some CTA, tactical asset allocation model. It is a very competitive space with little room for someone to be able to differentiate themselves. And this is where I feel option writing can be used as a strategic portfolio tool to create this differentiating and advantageous outcomes.
There are a zillion different ways to skin a cat when it comes to option writing. So are you just referencing a standard garden variety strategy like covered call writing, or are we talking about something different here?
Well, covered call writing is definitely the single most commonly used strategy, particularly amongst those retail advisors with stringent compliance departments. But there is an array of alternative ways to achieve similar outcomes through selling puts, credit spreads, short straddles, iron condors, or even iron butterflies. What I was thinking, Eric, was that we could cover the theory behind these different strategies over several episodes. But what I first want to talk about is the most important thing is why. Why would someone do this? Why would a money manager consider this? And what are the benefits? What I will explain is that the strategy often reduces a portfolio's volatility and can create more consistency.
Now, I've heard lots of people talking about using something like covered call writing as a strategy to enhance income in a portfolio. But you keep referring to this as a separate asset class. So please explain what you mean by that. Why do you feel that it should be differentiated from other assets in a portfolio and not just treated as a way of enhancing income that you're making from your existing equity portfolio?
Well, to me, it's important to be able to compartmentalize the strategy, because it becomes incredibly noisy when blending it as like an overlay over an existing long equity portfolio. When you engage in an option writing strategy, it allows you to build a component of the portfolio that strives to profit from theta or time decay. So as an example, a portfolio manager that like normally will allocate 70% of a portfolio mix to equity could alternatively have like 50% allocated to a long equity position while allocating 20% to a pure option writing strategy. So what does this do? Well, the cash flow reduces the volatility, as many of the option strategies have a negative delta associated with them. And through profiting from the time decay, it creates performance in periods when the markets are flat or inactive.
Okay, so if I understand you correctly, essentially what you're really saying is, instead of allocating, you know, all of your money to traditional asset classes like equities and bonds and so forth, you want to allocate a portion of an overall portfolio to what is really essentially a private placement in a small business that you're running. And that small business that you're running is an option writing business. And of course, option writing businesses have to have working capital in order to write those options. And so that's what you're doing as an investment. So as I understand you, that's the reason you're calling it a separate asset class. Did I get that part right?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. So I like your idea of covering the different strategies on several different shows because we don't have a time to do a whole lot more in this today. So why don't we just highlight some of the key points in terms of, let's say, the most common strategy in the industry, which is covered call writing. And then I'm going to ask our listeners to let us know via the listener discussion forum or info@macrovoices.com as an email, what other strategies they might like us to cover in future shows. So let's start with covered call writing for today.
Well, absolutely. And Eric, so like advisors and portfolio managers that utilize covered call writing often do it in three ways. The first and obviously the most simplest form is for just an advisor to simply buy an ETF or a fund that actually systematically writes options within it. This is really a hands-off approach. Now, there's an entire second wave of managers out there that simply allocate funds to an equity index like the S&P 500 and simply write on the index itself for simplicity. But finally, there's a third group of managers out there that allocate or create a basket of individual stocks to try to create the additional premium pickup from the added implied volatility that comes in individual stocks. Which one an advisor picks, it's obviously dependent on how much effort one is willing to exert in the management of those positions.
Okay, so let's suppose that you do this because it's going to require a bunch of time, as you say. If you want to get the best returns, which are exploited by taking advantage of the higher implied vol on a basket of individual stocks, that means you've got to manage that individual stock portfolio, and you've also got to put the time and energy into figuring out your strikes and where you're going to write your calls and so forth. So what kind of results, how does it affect the overall portfolio return profile in terms of performance if one employs the strategy which you're advising and allocates a certain percentage of their portfolio to what's essentially an option writing business?
Well, that's a good question, Eric. And the strategy will often yield stock market style returns, but rarely do you have an outlier performance to the upside, which is obvious why, because the counterparty, the call buyers, are the net benefactors of those big upside moves. You know, the best analogy that I always give is that old one of the bird in hand versus two in the bush. You know, the option writer is guaranteed an upfront premium that is earned upfront irrespective of the movement of the underlying, but that premium is earned for giving the upside to the speculator. So, you know, it's a trade-off, but the key thing to observe there is that when you treat this strategy as an independent asset class, you have another component of your portfolio that is already long that equity. So what this does is it makes it a very powerful diversifier.
Okay, so what you're really saying is it's not just a performance enhancer. It has a performance enhancement aspect of it. But what you're trading in order to get that enhanced performance is giving away just the outlier upside of a really big upside move, because when there's a huge upside move in something you've written a covered call against, you're giving away that big upside in exchange for premium. What that means really is the dreamers that are willing to pay you for the chance to make that big upside, which usually doesn't happen, is giving you steady income every month, even when nothing happens. So you let the dreamer pay you a premium, and occasionally the dreamer is right and your stock is called away from you, but you still made a very respectable profit on it. All you gave up was the outlier. Have I basically got the strategy right?
Absolutely. And it's definitely a strategy that I recommend. It's something that always is a good blend. You know, you don't want to just do the strategy alone, right? You still want to have a component of your portfolio that is long stocks and long equity, and you're participating in the markets. It's just it gives you something that just changes the overall risk reward profile of your whole asset mix, right? Anyway, Eric, is there anything else you wanted to add before we close things up?
Well, listeners, just look at the job Patrick is doing on guest recruiting. In the last month, we have had David Rosenberg, Jim Rogers, Jeff Snyder, Louis Vincent Gav, today Grant Williams. And as I look at the next month on the schedule, there's a bunch more big names coming up. How is this possible? Why are we finally getting the traction to bring you the people that you want to hear the most? It's because of your help, and we need more of it. So please retweet us when we announce the show. Use the embedded player that we now have available to add a Macro Voices player to your website. And most importantly, register register your free account at macrovoices.com, because the number of registered users we have is the primary statistic that Patrick uses to negotiate with guests to persuade them it's worth their time to come and give us a feature-length interview. The benefit to you is that you get our research roundup emails every week. This week, that would have given you two free sample issues of the extremely popular paid subscription newsletter, Things That Make You Go Hmm, by Grant Williams. So there's a lot of cool stuff there, and we also look for the links to the very best stuff that we can find each week on the internet. Patrick, what's in this week's research roundup?
Well, this week our listeners will find in that roundup the transcript for today's interview with Grant. Now, as always, the link on that will be active about 24 to 48 hours after the email is sent out. Now, also, like you just highlighted earlier, the links are in that email for Grant Williams' Things That Make You Go Hmm newsletters, and more importantly, a link to one of his recent videos that was posted out on YouTube. We also have the link for a report from Octavia Investments about their energy outlook for the winter of 2017. Some really interesting highlights in there. And as well, there's the World Bank report on trade developments in 2016. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's research roundup. So that does it for this week's episode. You know, we always appreciate the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. For those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share their work with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. Now, if you haven't already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.